Hello, this is Avani Dias. Thanks for joining me on the Hack Podcast. And on this episode, there have been some full-on concerns about a pack mentality at boys' schools. They start off as war cries, which are innocent enough at sporting events. We've all had them at school, but sometimes they turn into deeply sexist chants. This is one of them.
I wish that all the ladies!
I wish that all the ladies!
The holes in the room!
The holes in the room!
So we're going to question whether Australia should move away from single-sex education or if there are benefits. And later on this episode, we'll meet one of Australia's great marathon runners because he is so annoyed about a new Nike shoe helping people break world records. First, though, Germany's moving away from coal.
Hack.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer knows the rule on props.
It's coal.
On Triple J.
Whether you were directly hit by bushfires, you were struggling through the smoke and air pollution all over the country, or you've helped out on the ground, 80% of Aussies were directly affected by the bushfires this summer, according to new stats. Apparently, that's caused more Australians to care about the environment, and there's been a drop in support for coal. While we still figure out as a country how to transition jobs away from fossil fuels, Germany is on the way to totally shutting down its coal industry. And it's an interesting comparison because we do have very similar industries and they haven't sacked a single worker so far. Let's find out how with Tim Swanston.
It's pretty clear that the environment has become much more important as a topic of interest for people in response to these bushfires.
It wouldn't be out of line to say that the recent summer and the intense bushfires that claimed lives and properties had a pretty serious impact on how Aussies feel about climate change. That's been confirmed today with the first study of people's attitudes in the wake of the crisis. Nicholas Biddle from the Centre for Social Research and Methods says nearly 80% of the 3,000 people surveyed were affected by the fires in some way, with about 14% affected directly.
So whether you knew someone who had property threatened or damaged, and as someone who spent a lot of time in Canberra over the summer, whether you're affected by the smoke, as well as just whether you had a kind of a sense of anxiety or worry, either about yourself or about others. More than three quarters of the population reported at least one of those indirect effects.
While those effects were playing out, confidence in the federal government took a pummeling, down from 38.2% in October to 27.3%. And while back in October, just over 40% of people said the environment was one of the top two issues facing the country, now it's closer to half of Australians. Nicholas says the views of regional and inner city Aussies are not too dissimilar.
Even in outside of our capital cities, there's less than majority support for new coal mines. Even outside of our capital cities, more than half of the population think that climate change is an issue or think that climate change is going to be a threat to them.
The dwindling support for opening new coal mines is a pretty major takeaway, with only 37% of respondents now saying the government should allow more to open, compared to 45% in the middle of last year. But that's still about a third of people supporting new coal mines. So with that in mind, do we ever think the coal mining industry would be shut down?
Yeah, very hard to imagine that happening in the Australian context.
That's ABC investigative reporter Eric Campbell. He's recently been to Germany, where things are very different. Their government and mining companies have committed to phase out their coal industry within 18 years.
They have a much more combative political culture and a very different media. I mean, there's a broad consensus in Germany that climate change is a huge problem that needs to be addressed immediately, much more so than Australia.
The country has some pretty ambitious targets to close all mines by 2038. In 2018, Germany closed the last of their black coal mines because they were uneconomical. The distinction here is that black coal is generally deeper in the ground, but they continued to mine brown coal, generally speaking, a cheaper and dirtier fossil fuel that's worse for the environment. Here's Daniel Hoffinger, a climate activist from German group Ende Gelände.
We have to phase out coal in Germany right now. If we don't do that, it's going to be
quite literally the end of the world as we know it. The IPCC tells us that if we continue burning coal, we're running into catastrophic climate change.
The black coal mines that were shut down used to survive on government subsidies. So instead of using that money to fund the mines, they ended up using it to close them and cover the cost of retiring some workers and retraining the rest without a single worker being sacked.
It became a blueprint for what's happening now, which is a shutdown of the rest of the coal industry for environmental reasons. It won't be guaranteeing jobs for everyone. What it will be doing is funneling $65 billion into coal mining communities to try and create new industries, cleaner industries, to provide jobs for the next generation of workers when those mines and power plants do shut down.
Surprisingly, climate activists are some of the biggest critics of the plan, arguing the transition needs to happen sooner. Germany has some huge emissions reductions targets, which will be challenging to meet given they are at the same time shutting down nuclear power plants in response to the Fukushima disaster. There's also concern the success of the black coal shutdown experiment mightn't repeat itself by way of no job losses.
They can't guarantee that because there's just a lot more workers involved. What they will do, though, as I said, is put a lot of money into building, you know, new solar farms, new university startup businesses, anything where they can, you know, basically find new jobs for fairly skilled workers, because a lot of workers in the mining industry are quite skilled, and also give early retirement to the older miners.
Hack on Triple J.
Tim Swanson reporting there, and you can watch the full episode of Foreign Correspondent on Germany and coal. It's at 8 o'clock tonight on ABC TV, or you can stream it on iView. And yeah, when it comes to transitioning away from fossil fuels, there's this understandable concern about what that means for jobs. Call me if you work in coal mining, 1300 055 36. Would love to know your thoughts on this. We just heard there's a model that Germany's used that may be able to work here in Australia, but there are already a few local examples where towns have been transitioning away from these industries. Nick Appley is from Environment Victoria. He's been working in Victoria's Latrobe Valley and was campaigning for the Hazelwood coal-fired power plant to be closed. And that was the first power station to close in Australia, at least in part because of climate change. Nick, thanks for coming on the show. It's been more than 3 years since Hazelwood closed. 800 people worked there. Were workers at the focus of that closure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you know, we had seen previous closures at coal-fired power stations in the years before Hazelwood, but, you know, most of those didn't rate much of a mention in the news cycle. The closure of Hazelwood, you know, is probably one of the biggest power stations to have closed, but also one of the most iconic. You know, it was the dirtiest power station in Australia by quite a margin, one of the worst in the world. You know, but in the lead up to its closure, there certainly was a lot of focus on the workers, but probably a bit too late was really the problem. I think a lot of people saw the writing on the wall for Hazelwood quite some time before the company finally announced that it was going to close. And that really represented a lost opportunity to put in place a better transition plan than what we ultimately ended up with,
yeah.
Which, to be fair, was better than nothing and better than workers at previous coal-fired closures had received.
Yeah, I was reading that with a number of power stations, some workers were just given 4 months' notice. What should the government be doing to avoid situations like this as we do transition away from these industries in the years to come?
Yeah, I mean, workers at Hazelwood were given 5 months' notice, which isn't great in any situation, but it was made even worse by the fact that the company that owned it, ENGIE, was literally telling workers in the community, not 6 months before that, they were saying that they were going to be operating for another 13 or 14 years. And so that's really amounting to, like, deception of the workers who were making, you know, they were getting mortgages on the assumption that the company was telling them the truth. And the problem is, you know, power station closures are tricky for governments. You know, people want to know, are the lights going to go out and what's going to happen to my power prices? You know, both legitimate concerns, but for the most part, those can be managed. And it'll be managed much better if we plan for it. And unfortunately, here in Australia, in contrast to the lead-in story there about what's been happening in Germany, most governments in this country have not really been prepared to have a conversation, a mature conversation, about the fact that coal power stations will need to close, both because they're just old and conking out, but also for climate change reasons.
All right. Let's speak to Luke from Singleton. You're a coal worker. How do you feel about, this sentiment among Australians that's increasing and this will to move away from coal mining?
Hi, I completely understand the sentiment from Australians. I just wanted to say that in regards to the transition, that it'd be that if you're going to transition away from coal into more of a renewable sector, that the jobs be created in towns that are going to be most affected by it, because people's lives are going to be pretty much ruined. Like the value of their homes are going to significantly decrease, and they're going to struggle.
What would you need personally to transition away from coal to ensure that you would still have a job? How much time would you need, and what skills would you need, Luke?
I personally wouldn't transition away from coal since I get paid very well, and I'm setting myself up. If coal was phased out, I would just go to university and do something else.
Is there a way that the government could support you, though, to ensure that you wouldn't be out of a job?
If you're going to create a new renewable industry, base your jobs around the Hunter Valley and those towns in Queensland that are going to be most affected.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, thanks so much for the call, Luke. I really appreciate it. So many texts coming in. Someone says, coal will never be phased out while Parliament is full of boomers. Nick Abberley, who's from Environment Victoria, what do you think about that sentiment? Is the Parliament ready to actually transition away from coal?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear that our current federal government is not, and they've done everything in their power to delay the phase out of coal as much as possible. In other states, though, we're seeing quite a change. I mean, you look at the language that's coming out of state governments around the country, including Liberal state governments, Liberal oppositions here in Victoria, and the language is we need to be doing more about climate change. You know, I think this summer has been a real wake-up call for everyone on the need to cut emissions quickly. And the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Australia by far, is from burning coal. The maths is that if Australia wants to do its bit to achieve the objective of the Paris Agreement, we should stop burning coal by 2030. So we've got two choices. We can put our head in the sand and go, no, it's not going to happen. But that is not providing workers or communities with the plans that they need. The other option is we can actually go, okay, that's the challenge that we've got. Let's sit down together, as they did in Germany, unions, businesses, environment groups. Let's sit down and actually talk about what that plan could look like. I mean, we're seeing here in Australia that those groups are prepared to do that.
All right. Thank you so much, Nick Abberley from Environment Victoria, for shedding light on the expertise that you do have in this area. Someone on the text line says, Germany doesn't need to rely on coal anymore. They import a lot of gas and energy generated by plants in other EU countries. They've also seen huge amounts of redundancies. Another person says, I work at Loy Yang Power Station in Victoria, and I know this would never work because the companies would just take the money for themselves. They wouldn't be happy to lose money by giving it to workers. That's a really interesting point. And someone else has texted, industry is dying in Australia. You don't need 500 staff to run a solar or wind farm.
I wish that all the ladies!
I wish that all the ladies!
The holes in the room!
In green and blue stripy school blazers, a bunch of guys put St. Kevin's, an elite boys' school in Melbourne, on the map. They were on a train. They were singing that very sexist chant. It's something we've heard boys in a lot of schools around the countries have sung in the past. And now the ABC's Four Corners has uncovered what some students call this culture of a boys' club at St. Kevin's and its sister school.
Hack.
Yeah, the chants are definitely evidence of a toxic culture. And even though it might only be a few boys who are leading those chants, there are a lot of boys who would just sort of turn a blind eye and almost let those happen. I feel that we should have been given the probably the education to know that that's not okay and to call it out when it happened.
I think that these people are really kind and loving and sweet when they're by themselves, but then they're surrounded by their mates and you're all doing, you know, silly stuff and all your friends are like, oh, boys will be boys, this is what we do. And it's like, no, this behaviour is wrong. It's not boys will be boys. It's not anything like that. They're like, it's not okay.
I was 15 years old. I was amongst a group of boys and it was easier not to think about what I was doing than it was to actually take responsibility. Every guy knows the hot shame of being surrounded by his mates and looking weak or looking stupid. That is the main force that is driving this kind of behaviour, is the fact that everyone falls into line because that's what you're expected to do.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the students say this kind of thing starts innocently enough on the sporting field in the form of war cries. We've all been there at school. But then it develops into offensive chants about women and they're not properly called out by the school. This story's created a bigger question for us because we know that's not the only school where this kind of thing happens. Is it time Australia moved away from single-sex education? Or are there benefits and this was just an isolated case? Call me 1300 055 36. Now, Professor Andrew Martin has been studying this. He researches educational psychology. Andrew, thank you for coming on the show. We know that chants like this, what we just heard, happen at a lot of schools. How do they get to that offensive space?
Yeah, and most chants, you know, revolve around sport. Most of them sit within acceptable bounds of what we'd consider respectful. But there are some chants and war cries that clearly cross the line. There's no respect. They're offensive. They're intimidating. They threaten safety. And along the way, there's been slippage. And so the job of a school is ongoing education, like the speaker was talking about, zero tolerance on that latter chant, but also being vigilant to ensure that the former chant that starts off fairly benign and innocent, being vigilant that doesn't, you know, lead to potential for pack mentality and isn't a precursor or laying a foundation for disrespectful, offensive, intimidating chanting. And that's the same for any school tradition, I hasten to add.
Give me a call, 1300 055 36. If you went to a boys' school or a girls' school, I want to hear your perspective on this situation. Andrew, you're right in that a lot of schools have sports chants and so on. So when do they really cross that line from being just a fun way to bring everyone together to actually being this dangerous pack mentality where, yeah, people are not feeling necessarily safe?
Yeah, I think a few things play into this. One is that understanding that every group starts developing its own climate, its own norms, and many times, and most of the time probably, they're good norms. These groups are good for the individuals and they're good for community. But there are always factors in any group that are a risk factor and leaders need to be vigilant to those risk factors. So, for example, Banking Royal Commission. One of the risk factors in the banking world is greed. And so you've got to stay ahead of the curve. No, that's the risk factor.
Sure. Leaders of schools have to be sort of more vigilant in calling this kind of thing out. Is that what you mean?
And so gender is one of those factors that can be risky in terms of pack mentality, hypermasculinity, homophobia. Good schools know this. They stay ahead of the curve and continually emphasise and model respect, tolerance, individuality and safety.
All right, Darcy's called in from the Shire. What's your experience been? Have you been to a boys' or girls' school?
I went to a Catholic boys' school growing up and these calls and these chants are like an apparent thing that is not frowned upon or shamed upon in any way, shape or form. And honestly, if I think done in an okay manner, with not such bad talking towards women, it's not that bad of a thing if it's something for all the boys to G up before a game or something along those lines.
Yep, totally. Was there any point where you felt that it did get a bit offensive or get a bit, you know, that kind of pack mentality, or was it always a positive thing?
Trust me, it wasn't always a positive thing. It was all the boys in the footy shed after a game, chin and whatnot. But, like, as now that looking back on it, it could have been. But, like, now that I'm older and I've grown up, I can see that what we were saying could have been a little bit inappropriate.
Yeah, right. And was there anyone sort of calling out that kind of thing at your school, Darcy?
Not at all. The teachers used to stand there and join in.
Yeah, right. And so what do you think you would change? Would you, you know, would you be maybe not participating in those chants, or was it something that you just had to do because you were around?
Well, it was something that you did because you were one of the footy boys.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense.
It was sort of a pack mentality. You'd never do it on your own.
Yeah.
But if you're in a group of 30 boys, you'll do it, of course.
Yeah, Andrew, we've heard a lot of what Darcy's saying in that, you know, you're young, you're there, and you feel like you've got to participate. Is that something you're hearing as well?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things, individual factors. So fear of being disapproved of, fear of being left out plays into this. But also, you know, the school's job to give individuals the confidence and support them in speaking up if they don't want to be part of something, but also making sure that the groups within the school allow someone not to be part of the group if they don't want to. And there's this two-way traffic that needs to happen. Someone feeling safe to say, look, this isn't right, I don't want to be a part of it, but also the groups themselves to listen to that and to respect individuals who may not want to be part of things.
Let's talk to Jasmine from the Northern Beaches. So you went to an all-girls school, right? So what was the situation like for you?
Well, I went to an all-girls school and we had a really beautiful culture. We were really well educated on how to treat people and we had a very good unity in the school as well. But it wasn't what we saw all around the place. There were a lot of girls' schools who as well, a lot of kind of bad attitudes came out of because they weren't fostered in the same way, I guess.
Yeah, how did they sort of make that kind of unity good in your school?
A lot of it just came down to kind of the education and the seminars that we did. My school, you know, I went to Riverside Girls High School and we really pushed for supporting each other coming into the senior years. Admittedly, it was only in the senior years that shift happened.
What were the boys like, your brother's schools?
So we had two particular brother schools and there was a very visible difference. One of them was a footy school and the other one wasn't, driven more by education. And the footy school, the boys that got caught up in the footy game, they very much fell into that, you know, didn't treat women the right way and they had those chants and there was a very different culture to what it was in, you know, the school where a lot of my close friends went to. And they were always, again, came down to education. They did a lot of seminars on how to treat women and how to behave.
Yeah, right. That's so interesting, Andrew, about the sporting aspect of it. Is that something that contributes to that kind of culture?
Look, I think sport lends itself to high energy. It lends itself to externalising behaviour. A lot of sport tends to be physical. And so, as I was saying before, a school needs to be mindful that there are certain activities that are likely to amplify potentially unsafe and disrespectful, you know, behaviour and dynamics.
Sure.
I really appreciate the previous caller also identifying when it works well. There are actually many fine examples of groups of boys volunteering, doing charity work, mentoring. It does happen, and it's these models we need to really be looking at and putting energy towards in cultivating in all our schools.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say as well, Andrew, that it's not all boys' schools that are in this situation and not all sporting schools that are in this situation, but down to how these sorts of behaviours are called out in different ways. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. Within a school, there's still collections of groups, whether it's co-ed or single-sex, and each of those groups, the leadership needs to manage those groups effectively and make the most of the opportunities those groups allow and guard against any risk those groups might present.
All right. Andrew Martin, who is a professor of educational psychology, really appreciate your thoughts in this space. So many texts coming in. Someone says, I called a group of boys out for that pack mentality on Sex's Chance and then became a target for their chance. I'm sorry to hear that. On the Triple J Hack Facebook page, Tom says, reputation is more important than student welfare at St. Kevin's, it seems. Catherine in Newcastle commented, this isn't the only boys' school that are wrongly educating boys in regards to women and their behaviour towards them. Single-sex schools are not helping us move forward or helping make boys into the men they deserve and can be. This is Hack on Triple J. Let's talk running.
Hack. When a world record is broken, it's normally a cause for celebration. But a controversial shoe has some in the marathon world crying foul.
On Triple J.
You know, when you see athletes breaking world records, it's like, have we as humans become stronger and faster over time? Or is technology helping us get there? So Ugandan runner Joshua Cheptegei smashed the 5-kilometre world record on Sunday. So that's the length of your local park run. He did it in 12 minutes and 51 seconds. And he beat the previous world record by 27 seconds. That's huge. And in the clip of him running, he's just bouncing along so quickly. He's wearing these bright pink shoes. But those shoes are really controversial. They're called the Nike Vaporfly. And studies have shown they make more use of a runner's energy. And Nike claims they increase efficiency by 4%. So marathon great. And Australia's former world record holder, Robert De Castella, is here. How did you feel about Cheptegei's world record on the weekend?
Look, I'm not a fan of the shoes, Avani. I think, I am a fan for technology in terms of making running more enjoyable and reducing injuries and all those sorts of things. But when you start putting in carbon fiber plates and things that act like springs, and especially when the company, when Nike have patented, and it means that no other shoe companies are allowed to use the same technology, it really doesn't make it an even playing field. And the concept of running, which is, you know, sort of running, man has been doing it forever. And admittedly, you know, we've moved from bare feet to shoes, and shoes have evolved a lot. But, you know, we've never really had a spring-like effect inside the running shoe. And, you know, you can have two runners of exactly the same ability. And if one happens to be sponsored by Nike and the other one's not, and one wears their shoes and beats the other one, I don't think that's fair.
Robert, the threshold for world athletics is if the product can be bought by a normal person, so these Vaporfly shoes are $300 on the market, then they are allowed to be used in competition. So is that a fair enough kind of target?
Well, I think the rules say something like that they've got to be reasonably available to everyone. And the
$300 is a lot, I guess.
it's a lot, and you get about 400K out of them, and then you've got to throw them away and get another pair.
Right.
But there are a lot of runners out there, you know, sort of recreational runners that if they can, you know, spend, you know, sort of $300 or $400 and run a PB in their local park run, then they're probably quite excited to do that. It's probably at the elite level where, you know, sort of I probably have the biggest concern. And I know World Athletics are starting to look at it, and these shoes have been out there for 4 or 5 years, and, you know, five of the most recent world records, and now this one in the 5K just recently, six, have all been set in these shoes. So there is a real, advantage, a mechanical advantage, and it's an unfair advantage at the moment.
Where do you think we should draw the line then? We are about to hit the news, Robert, but, you know, obviously technology keeps developing, so what needs to happen?
Yeah, well, like, technology is in everything. You know, the FINA just recently banned those flotation swimsuits, tennis use technology and limit technology for rackets and cycling and everything else. So we want to use technology, but we do need to control it, and we do need to make sure that it's not patented by one company or the other, which prevents everyone else from having access to it.
All right, Robert De Castella, who is one of Australia's great marathon runners, really appreciate your expertise in this area. Max from Alfred Point says, when will this argument about running shoes stop? You can just as easily say wearing shoes full stop is increasing an athlete's running abilities. Fair enough.
Hack
on Triple J.
Thanks heaps for listening. I'll catch you later.